So tonight we'll do one of the final metta meditations, and we've been doing this each week for the last nearly three months, so you all must be pretty good at it by now, yeah? Hopefully we've got a bit more of an understanding of what this practice is about, and it's always important to remember in mind with the metta practices that it's not just about feeling good, although it does that. It's not just about being nice to people, although it does that. It's not just about making our minds happy, although it also does that. But it's ultimately, it's about liberation. And that's what it's about. It's about actual liberation. And in Buddhism, there are two aspects of this liberation that we call Cetta Vimutti, or freedom of the heart, and Panya Vimutti, or freedom through understanding, through wisdom. Metta meditation is specially attuned to leading towards this Cetta Vimutti, this freedom of the heart. It means the freedom of the heart from any kind of afflictions, ill will, negative emotions, and all of those kinds of things. That's what we're doing this metta practice for. And that freedom is something the Buddha described, like when a person who is ill, and then they get better, and they're able to get out of their bed, go around and do their activities. And such a feeling of lightness and joy to that. But ask, what does that joy consist of? Or like the freedom of somebody who's crossing the desert, and as they're crossing the desert they run out of food and drink and they get terribly oppressed by the conditions there, the heat and so on, and they're very fearful that they won't go to cross, but then suddenly they make it. They see off in the distance, they finally see an oasis, they see people, and they can make it. They survive, they have something to drink and to eat. And so there's like this happiness, but what does that happiness consist of? Or again, another simile the Buddha used, like the simile of somebody who gets out of jail. You get locked up in jail. So they throw you in there for no good reason. Lock the door. You're in there for years, you don't know why. And then they let you out. One day somebody comes along, no explanation, no reason, you don't know why. And they open the door and they say, you're a free man, you can walk. And you walk out of the gate, how good would you feel? But again, what actually does that feeling consist of? What is that feeling of freedom? What is that experience of freedom? So that feeling of freedom, because it's a release from something, its essence actually is nothing. Its essence is the absence of oppression, the absence of affliction. And that's what's happy, that's what's beautiful, that's what's blissful. So like the psychological counterpart of that is that our mind becomes happy. When we're freed from those kinds of oppressions, the mind naturally becomes happy. We feel this pleasant feeling. And that's something concrete, that's a thing. It's something we can grab hold of, we can pay attention to. There's an actual something in our consciousness. Our consciousness is full of this feeling. But again, that feeling is not it. That's not the essence. Well, the essence is that release. The feeling is just like our psychological reaction or response to that freedom. But the essence is that freedom, and that doesn't have any essence. That doesn't have any intrinsic or inherent existence or being. It's merely the absence from affliction. So this is the idea of freedom and happiness in Buddhism, but unfortunately it's a bit abstract for many people. It's like, you know, you can talk about it and people think you're a bit strange, or it's not like a goal which most people aim for in their lives. What they want is something, what we all want, is something a bit more obvious. So this is a feeling which sometimes is called spiritual materialism, wanting to get something out of your meditation. It's important to recognize that even though spiritual materialism is crude, in a sense, and it's not the way, as long as you have this you'll never be enlightened, but it's a reality, so you've got to work skillfully with it. So one of the ways to work skillfully with the simple fact that we all are spiritual materialists, unless we're really arahants, then is to say, okay, let's give our mind some juicy tidbits, let's give our mind pleasant things to play with that are pleasant in a wholesome way, in a good way. And through doing that, then you can learn about the bliss of letting go, about the bliss of freedom. So this is one of the purposes, the main purpose of developing this metta practice, is that it gives you a taste of what this bliss of freedom is about. And when we're doing the practice, as we've learned over the last weeks, to go in four stages, loved one, oneself, loved one, neutral one, and the disliked one. And so we'll do those four stages again today. So I want you now to just think of one person in each of those categories, someone in the loved person category, someone in the neutral, and someone in the disliked category. Okay? And as we do the metta, we'll develop loving kindness in turn for each of these four people, and then we'll go on to try and see what it means, what it feels like to expand our loving kindness out beyond our bodies. So I ask you to sit, get ready for meditation now. As we sit together here in the present moment, noticing the fields of energies, sensations within our body, painful feelings, comfortable feelings, and just reminding ourselves that this moment, this present moment, has never been before, and it never will be again. Is completely and utterly unique, unrepeatable. Moving the mind inside the heart, bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. making the words steady, clear. Putting meaning, putting heart into every word. You continue. Can you see that light that starts to shine there? Can you see? Can you feel that feeling of metta that starts to glow when your mind is pure and maintaining that thought of metta? Carefully and gently rest your mind together with that feeling of metta, very delicately holding that in your mind. Feeling to fill up and soak through the whole body, from the top of the head to the soles of the feet. second stage. May that loved person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping your mind collected within the body. Keeping your awareness on that whole body image. To the third person, may that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping energy and clarity in the mind. And then the disliked person, may that disliked person be happy, may they be happy, may they be happy. feel the metta for the disliked person strong and clear. Gradually allow the mind to expand out from the body. May all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. Not thinking of each individual person in here, but simply letting that field of metta spread out and fill the room. From the room going out further, may all people in Bundanoon be happy. May all people in Bundanoon be happy. May all people in Bundanoon be happy. Feeling that glow of awareness spread out, radiating over that whole area. And may all people in the Southern Highlands be happy. May all people in the Southern Highlands be happy. May all people in the Southern Highlands be happy. And then keep on going. May all people in New South Wales be happy. May all people in New South Wales be happy. May all people in New South Wales be happy. Just feeling the metta spreading out. May all people in Australia be happy. May all people in Australia be happy. May all people in Australia be happy. Finally, may all people in the world be happy. May all people in the world be happy. May all people in the world be happy. Letting down any boundaries or limits on your loving kindness. And letting it flood over the whole world. gradually bringing the metta back in. May all people in Australia be happy. May all people in New South Wales be happy. May all people in Bundanoon be happy. May all people in this room be happy. Back into one's own body. May that disliked person be happy. May the neutral person be happy. May the loved one be happy. May I be happy. And letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away. Letting the mind settle into a neutral, clear, open space. And a couple of minutes to review over the meditation, reflecting on what that experience was like. Reflecting on how your mind changed and developed during the meditation. Finally, we can share the merits. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally attain Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. Tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa majhenako bhikkhave tathagato dhammam deseti. So that short line that I just said there in Pali is a phrase that occurs frequently in the Nidana Sanghita. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma by the middle. So we're all familiar with the middle way, Majjhima Patipada, the middle practice. But there's also like the middle teaching, Majjhena Desana. Teaching by the middle. And the same way the Buddha says, avoiding these two extremes, I teach the Dhamma by the middle. And that is to say, you must mean sati idang hoti. When this is, that is. Imas upada idang upajati. The duty, the arising of this is the arising of that. You must mean asati idang na hoti. When this isn't, that is not. Imasa nirodha dang nirujhati. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So this is what they call the idapachayata, the formula for specific conditionality. So this is specific in the sense that it's talking about certain particular causes and conditions. With this there, that arises. So it's not a general formula saying things have causes, or everything is caused. It's a specific theory, specific statement on causality. Certain kinds of things cause certain other kinds of things. And it's very interesting to consider carefully how these things are phrased. This is one of the, I find, the truly remarkable things about the phrasing of the teachings in the suttas, especially in the Pali Canon, is that, try as I might, I really just can't find anything wrong with it. And if I want to look for philosophical problems in how Buddhism is formulated, if I want to look at all of the later teachings from whatever school, if I want to try and find some problems with it, I always can, sooner or later, I usually do. But with these teachings in the suttas, there's something about them which is so carefully described. It's quite uncanny that something so simple can be described in a way that just hits the mark so well. One time when I was reading some about history of Western philosophy, I was reading some of the arguments of a philosopher called David Hume. And he was a very famous British philosopher who, one of his most important arguments was an argument against causality. And he essentially argued that the notion of causality was untenable, or was just like an abstraction. It's a bit like ideas like God or the soul or something like that. They're things that we can talk about, but we can never really see. What we can actually see is patterns of things. We can see when things occur, but this idea of a cause, of one thing causing another, we can't actually see that. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's true, isn't it? I can see that there's a plant that's growing in the ground, and then I can see that there's a seed that's planted, and I can see that there's a tree that's grown up from that. But I can't see the cause, the actual fact of the causality there. I can't actually see that. All I can see is the thing itself. So I began to get worried when I read this. I'm thinking, what, the Buddha's teaching is all about causality. Does that mean dependent origination is wrong? I began to get a little bit concerned. I was thinking, does that mean the Buddha is really just teaching like all these soul theorists, like, you know, in theistic religions you talk about like the prime mover, the first cause of all things. Is Buddhism really just, when all is said and done, another doctrine like that, where you're talking about mysterious entities that you can't really see, you can't really experience, you can't really know? It's just an idea. So as I was contemplating that, this, I reflected again on this very basic formula of idapachayata, imasming sati idam hoti. When this is, that is. And I realized that actually this is a very subtle way of phrasing the nature of causality that escapes the criticism that David Hume brought. As you can see, when the Buddha's talking about things, he's just talking about what is. Imasming sati, when this is, idang hoti, that is, or that comes to be. So what this is talking about is not some kind of mysterious principle which is like operating behind experience, which we can't see. What you're talking about is seeing what is that phenomenon, that experience, that object that is present in my consciousness. And you can see that there's this thing and there's another thing, and you can see that there's a pattern. So there's like a pattern where this arises and then that arises. And after a while you can start to predict these patterns when you become familiar with them. So it's not like inferring to a very mysterious philosophical thing which we can call a cause, which somehow lies behind this experience. And this is a philosophical mistake which I think many of the later schools of Buddhism fell into, that they started to think about causes and so on as being like mysterious forces which somehow are lying behind the experience that we're seeing. But I don't think that's what the Buddha was talking about. When he's talking about dependent origination, he was talking about seeing meaning in the patterns of the way that experience happens to us. Talking about dependent origination the last few weeks, if you remember a couple of weeks ago I gave a talk on especially the first few links of dependent origination, ignorance, sankharas, or volitional activities or something, acts of will, then consciousness, vijnana, and nama rupa. And we talked about these in some depth. And I think we agreed that they are in some ways quite difficult or abstruse ideas, especially this idea of vijnana and nama rupa is very subtle. We can understand it very simply, or an initial understanding is that vijnana is like the knowing, nama rupa is like the known, or is the known, the knowing and the known, like the inner and the outer of our experience. So the vijnana is like this feeling. We add up this feeling as if it were in here. Well, of course, it's actually formless, isn't it? It's actually not in the body or anything like that. But it feels to us as if there's this center of knowing inside our body here. And it feels to us that the things that we know, for example, sense objects, or else thoughts and ideas, concepts, memories, images and so on, they feel to us like they're external. And the Buddha actually talks about this, like bahidha nama rupa, the external nama rupa, or nama rupa that's outside. And that means that these objects of consciousness are, as it were, external. They're like the skin of the consciousness. So we talked a little bit about these things, and we talked a little bit about how this nama rupa is pointing to, or an implication of this, is the linguistic structure of experience. That is to say, that we can only make sense of the world of sense experience, we can only operate in that through using language. Or, to put it another way, language is the tools, concepts are the tools that we use to make sense of the world. Of course, language here is being used in the most broad sense of like symbolic patterns. It doesn't necessarily have to be a literal language, because, for example, animals also make sense of the world without using language as such. But what I'm talking about is like symbol systems, or like pre-linguistic systems, where we can use to filter our experience, make sense of it, we can use to operate in the world. And we can see that when as we're learning to do these things, these are skills which we have to learn, that the way that these kinds of concepts will cause our consciousness to grow and mature will be dependent on our existential situation. That means to say that what is important for your life? What is important, for example, for a newborn baby? What do they have to identify? Obviously, number one, they have to identify mum, because she's going to give me food. And so that's the most important thing. And so those very key things that you have to learn to identify very soon, very early, food, comfort, safety and danger. Yeah, you have to learn to recognize when there's going to be a threat. All of these kinds of things you learn very quickly, and you learn to process those things. And as time goes on, as you grow up, become more mature, then gradually your processing will become more sophisticated. So for example, when you're young, maybe you learn that snakes are harmful, so you get very scared every time you see a snake. But then after a while you realize that you learn that actually snakes aren't harmful unless you tread on them or disturb them or something, and usually there's no danger to be seen from snakes, so you won't get as afraid because your consciousness is becoming more sophisticated in the way it's processing those things. And of course the incredible thing, the wonder of all this, is that we can sit here tonight and talk about this and think about it and reflect in ourselves on these matters. That's the extraordinary thing. Our consciousness has reached such a point that it's able to turn back, as it were, and reflect, as it were, on itself, as it were. There was one very interesting description or attempt at analyzing how this came about, which I think has quite a lot in common with the Buddha's point of view. And that was done by a fellow called Julian Jain in the 1970s. And he developed quite a subtle theory about these things, which I won't go into all the details, but leaving aside his technical vocabulary, what he suggested was that this ability to reflect on oneself is something which we learn, or happens as an unintended consequence of the word I. It's almost like it's an accident. Almost, not quite like it. It's not quite an accident, but it's almost as if it's an accident. So we start off using the word I as one of the most basic non-reflective nouns. It's simply a label that we stick on this thing here. But because it's very evident to us that this thing here is always changing, our feelings are always changing and so on, then the relationship between that label, which stays the same, and the experience to which that label is stuck onto becomes very questionable, becomes very puzzling. What is this I? And so we start to ask this question. We have this label already in use, and this is talking about I, but what do I mean when I talk about this I? It seems, before we start to reflect about it, it seems obvious enough. But the more we start to think about it, the more we go into it, the less we realize we know about it. And this is one, of course, one of the great signs of the dawning of knowledge. The more you really know, the more you're starting to unlearn, unknow those things that you thought you knew. So in dependent origination, it's very useful to think about these particular steps of dependent origination as exemplified, primarily exemplified by the conception, evolution in the womb, birth, and growing up of a human being. That's not to say that they can't be applied more broadly than that, but a very important application of this is the application of the development of an individual, childhood development. And so, like in the womb, we can think of this vijnana and nama rupa as all there, but the sense activity hasn't yet really started. It only gradually starts to develop in the womb, and then as one's born, one learns how to use the senses more and more and more in more refined ways. So this is this stage in dependent origination of the six senses. We talked a bit about this in the Pali class, like the six fields. Of course, the sixthness of it is a bit odd, isn't it? I always think that's a bit odd. Why have we got six senses? Why not seven or eight? Why can't we be like bats, for example? We can sense things by sending out sonar. Why can't we sense things by, for example, magnetic radiation or gravity, for example? Why do we have these particular senses and not others? Seems all a bit arbitrary, doesn't it? A bit strange. Obviously, these ones have proven to be successful in evolution. So we contemplate each one of these senses is extraordinarily sophisticated and subtle. For example, our eyes, even with our modern technology and development of cameras and things like that. Yes, it's true, we can do some things with cameras that we can't do with our eyes, but there's many, many things that each one of us does with our eyes that no camera can ever hope to emulate. We're automatically, for example, adjusting to different levels of light. We're automatically able to see depth in three dimensions. We're automatically able to filter our visual experience so that, for example, if I look out the back of this monastery, I can differentiate between a tree and the sky and a rock and the grass, and we can filter our experience very quickly, very easily, without even having to think about it. And so much going on in this sense field. And of course the Buddha gave a very straightforward, rational and functional description of how these senses work. He wasn't particularly concerned to explain the organic basis for the eye and talk about the lenses and all of those kinds of things. Nor did he feel that need to kind of evoke some mysterious force. So by comparison, if we look into the Upanishads, they will talk about things like that person in the eye. They'll use terminology like that. So it's almost like you kind of have to invoke some kind of metaphysical idea of a person who lives in your eye to explain the workings of the eye. But the Buddha looked at this and said, this is complete rubbish, this doesn't explain anything. And this is like one of these classic fallacies, which relates to what I was talking about before, about the nature of causality, that the Buddha didn't need to invoke hidden entities behind experience in order to explain what was going on. And this kind of fallacy is like the fallacy of the puppeteer. It's like saying that the world that we see is like the world on the stage, And in fact, it's just a puppet show, and behind that there's the puppeteer. So that's an image which is quite striking and has a certain resonance, but of course it doesn't really explain anything. All it tells us is that the people on the Punch and Judy show, why they're acting in that way and why they're expressing those emotions. But it doesn't tell us anything about the puppeteer themselves, and it leaves completely open the question of who is the puppeteer and what are their wishes and their desires. So there's always this tendency in religions and in philosophies to make some kind of explanation by shifting things behind the curtain. And that curtain can be many things. In philosophy, the curtain tends to be some kind of very sophisticated terminology and ideas. In religion, it's like a veil tends to be like a veil of holiness. And like words, we use words, as soon as we put words in capital letters, you know, we start to put words in capital letters like soul or spirit with a capital letter or self with a capital letter. And that's a dead giveaway. As soon as you see people starting to use capital letters like that, that's an absolutely dead giveaway. That you say, ah, there's a curtain is coming up. These words don't mean anything. They're not pointing to anything that actually is real in the world. All they're doing is creating some kind of emotional response. So we talk about words like spirit or soul or something like that. Those words are designed to evoke some kind of emotional response in you and to give you the feeling that you understand, that you know, or at the very least, to give you the feeling that somebody understands, somebody knows. Maybe I don't know, but at least God knows. Of course, God with a capital G, the higher power with a capital H and a capital P, they know, and they've got it all sorted out, so I can trust them. In Buddhism, we do the same thing with some of our texts, for example, our Abhidhamma texts, and we call these things the higher teachings with a capital H and a capital T. And we say that all the questions are asked and all the answers are given, and they're all there in those books. And of course, the books are designed very carefully so that they're completely and utterly unreadable, so that nobody ever is able to actually print one of those books. If they did, the Abhidhamma books I worked out once, it would reach from Melbourne halfway to Sydney, okay? If we actually printed it all out, there's supposed to be something like 200 billion questions and answers in the Patana, the last book of the Abhidhamma. So if it was all there, that would be all the answers. They're all there. Rest assured, take it easy, okay? It's all taken care of, down to the last dot and the last dash. Everything you need, it's all there. So if we look, rather than thinking about what's the content of these things, sometimes is misleading. It's not important so much what the content, but you see how it's used and how it actually functions in a religious community. These things function by creating a sense of authority. Very similar to how the pyramids work. You think about the pyramids, walking across the desert, and you see these unbelievable stone structures, which are just utterly incredible. Up until maybe 1,000 years or more ago, then they were covered in white marble, shining white marble on the outside. So these white, perfect, geometrical, shining figures looming out of the desert. What could they possibly be? Can you imagine the impact that they would have on people? And this is the way that we create religious ideas. The medieval cathedrals, the same thing. In Buddhism, as I was saying, we often use our doctrines, the sophistication and size of our doctrines and books. They create the same kind of thing. We can't really understand it or fathom it. All we can do is fall to our knees in front of it and prostrate ourselves. And so this is like a kind of pseudo-explanation, which is really hiding the truth behind some kind of veil. So the Buddha didn't feel the need to invoke these kinds of things when he talked about how your senses operate. His description doesn't consist of endless technical terminology and lists of things which you can't really see or understand. Chakuncha paticha rupecha upajakicha kuvinyanam. Dependent on the eye and visible forms arises eye consciousness. It's very simple. The eye, we know what the eye is like. This physical ball of jelly sitting here in our heads. It's a very complex physical thing, it's difficult to draw limits on it. For example, you know, we know that the eye is attached to various muscles and they kind of help us to focus and all of these kinds of things, so they should be included as well. And also the nerves and apparatus and so on that helps us to process those things and shunt the information around. They're also part of the eye here, like that physical basis of vision, dependent on the eye and forms, those things that we see. And notice we don't have to get into debates about whether those forms really, truly, woolly exist out there in the real world. Who cares? Who gives a toss? The fact is that when I open my eyes, I see, and that seeing is the problem. That seeing is what stimulates feelings and stimulates thoughts of aversion and attachment. And that's what's important. That's the problem that we have to answer. Sotancha paticca saddaccha upajati sota vijnanam. Dependent on the ear and sounds arises ear consciousness. So these consciousnesses, this awareness through the sense activity is not something which exists by itself, or not something which is just kind of hanging around waiting to work. It's something which is stimulated by the actual impact with these sense objects. Elsewhere, the Buddha clarifies that what's also required there is like an act of conscious attention. Your mind has to engage with these things. And just like many of you may have experienced if you're in meditation, and your meditation is quite deep, and you know, you start to not be aware of sounds around you, and all of a sudden somebody may make a noise and jerks you back to that ear consciousness, and before that the ear consciousness wasn't there. So this is something which is also relevant here. And in fact, that's not an innovation of the Buddha, but is also found in the Upanishads as well, that act of attention is required. So all of these things coming together, dhyanang sangati paso, the coming together of these three things is contact. It's the contact of the coming together. Notice that the Buddha says the coming together of these three things is contact. That is to say, contact is not a thing. Contact is not another kind of entity which sort of sits over next to all these other entities. Contact is just the word we use to describe that event when those three things happen all together in the same place at the same time. Boom. There's that moment of conscious experience, and that coming together of all those three things, the coincidence of all those things, the cooperation of all those three things is what we call contact. It's a label that we give to that. Passapaccaya vedana. When we experience that contact, we feel. This is quite automatic. This is not something we can stop. Even for an arahant or for the Buddha, they be contacted by things and they feel. That is a very beautiful discourse, the Bala Pandita Sutta in the Nidana Sanyutta, where the Buddha says that both a fool and a wise person, the fool and the sage, having been born in this world with their consciousness and their body, and they have experiences through the six sense fields of pleasure or pain or neutral feeling. And both the sage, that is to say the arahant, and the white and the fool have the same thing. They're in that same situation. The basic existential situation is the same. You are here now and you have consciousness in this body, and that consciousness experiences through the six sense fields pleasure and pain. So there's nothing you can do about it. You can't escape from the fact that you experience pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings. This is what life consists of. What you can do, of course, is you can change the way that you respond to these kinds of feelings. The normal response when we have pleasant feeling, boom, craving goes. We want more. The normal response when we have unpleasant feeling is aversion. We want to get rid of it. Don't like that. normal response when we have neutral feeling is delusion. We get bored, we're not interested in it. Drift off, the mind drifts off, loses interest and then falls asleep. These three patterns of response, that's what we can train our mind to do, to avoid. So these patterns of response are what we call that craving. So this is something that we can all contemplate, isn't it? It's something that we can all experience. When I was the storeman in Bodhinyana, I wrote up a sign, I don't know if it's still there, but I wrote up a sign in the stores and put it there, contact conditions feeling, feeling conditions craving. Because of course when you open the door to the storeroom, all the monks open it and they come in, they always want things. Oh, I didn't know we had one of them. Oh, that looks like a nice torch. There's this contact conditions feeling, feeling conditions craving. So this section of dependent origination is the most important for our meditation. Okay? So people often regard dependent origination as it's a very kind of abstruse theory, it's this very kind of difficult concepts and so on and so forth, and they find it hard to realize how it's relevant in their practice. So the trick to that, the simple trick to that is, of course, that don't worry about it. Watch those things that you can watch, those things that you can understand. Don't worry about the whole 12 links in your practice. Worry about those links that are most directly experienced. And don't worry about making some kind of theory up about those things. If you try and doing that, then you fall into that same mistake that I've been talking about throughout this talk, of like putting things behind the curtain, explaining things away, using words to substitute for understanding. So rather than doing that, our approach to understanding this teaching should be twofold. One is through reading, considering, thinking about, talking about the teaching and getting a good theoretical, philosophical understanding. The second aspect is through direct experience in our meditation. And when we do that part, just focus on these central links, six senses, contact, feeling, craving. That's all. Just watch that. Don't worry about all the rest of it. When you're in your meditation, use this as a very, very powerful kind of vipassana meditation. You watch how you respond to sense activity. You're not trying to look behind, when something happens in your eye, or your ear, you're not trying to kind of look behind that and think, what is that? What is that really? What is that feeling? What's behind that? What you're trying to look at is, what is that connection? What is that interrelationship between that sense object and you? What's your inner response to that? And this is the important thing which I think is sometimes neglected or marginalized in Buddhism when we start talking about vipassana and insight. It all becomes very objectified. Is that we've got these lists of things, we've got these lists of dhammas, and your idea is to sort of go through and work out what all these dhammas are and experience them and so on. It's all kind of out there. There's all this stuff out there that you have to kind of analyze and categorize and so on. But what the Buddha's talking about here is not so much all of that stuff, but more, how do you respond? Where's that feeling and that craving? Where's that craving come from? How does your mind move when you have sense impact hit you? What does it do? How does that change your mind when you see a person who's very sexually attractive? When they walk into the room, how does that change you? How does that hit your mind? How does it hit your mind when you're sitting there in the morning at breakfast time and somebody says they're going to make such and such for lunch? And you think, oh, you start looking forward to that, and you've got like 3 hours to look forward to having this kind of meal of such and such, whatever it is. 3 hours of looking forward to it and 3 minutes of eating it. How do these things affect your mind? How does it affect your mind when you're touched with like worldly dhammas, when people come and praise you, say, oh, you've done a wonderful job, you're so kind, you're so generous? What about dispraise when you're touched with that? What does that do to your mind? Someone criticizes you, do you get upset? Do you lash back at them? What happens there? How does that affect your mind? So these are the things that you need to learn to appreciate and to contemplate in meditation, in Vipassana meditation. And of course, it's very difficult to do this because we're bombarded by so much sense experience. And this is, of course, one of the reasons, one of the key benefits of doing a lot of samatha meditation. By practicing samatha, we reduce the sense input. We reduce the activities going on in the mind. We reduce the amount of information we have to keep processing. Now, remember, I started off this talk talking about vijnana and nama rupa. Nama rupa, I'm understanding as linguistic processing of experience. So the more data there is, the more abstract our labeling system has to be for that. We've all experienced that in our lives, don't we? For example, if I go to a company or a government department or something, I get reduced to a number. Yeah, they have to use a number rather than calling me by a name, because there's probably thousands of people with that name. They can't identify people by their, you know, appearance or by their character or personality or age or anything like that which is meaningful. You have to abstract and make it something completely meaningless, totally arbitrary, just a string of digits, and that's the person. That's exactly the same thing we do in our mind. The more information we take in, the more we have to abstract our experience and turn it into something which is actually meaningless and quite divorced from the experience itself. So again, to repeat that example, when we're in like a family situation or in a small community situation like this monastery, we don't need to use numbering systems and all of those kinds of things. We know each other. We know each other's names. And we can talk with each other and relate to each other, and we know much more than the names. We know each other's personalities. We know a little bit about our backgrounds, about our age, about our preferences, about our skills, about our dislikes, and all of those kinds of things. So we can relate to each other on that level. But as more and more and more people come in, those personal things, we can't take so much account of those things. Imagine what it would be like if there was not 10 or 15 people in this monastery, but 100 people. Obviously, we couldn't know everybody in the same way. What if there was 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000? What if there was a stream of hundreds of millions or billions of pieces of information coming in to our mind at all times? How intimate can we be with each piece of information? That's what the reality is. That's what our lives are. Our lives are this constant bombardment of countless billions and billions of pieces of information. I don't mean pieces literally like lumps, I'm just using it as an example for showing how much there is. Pieces of information which, each of which has to be processed or assimilated somehow. So to process that, we have to abstract to a very, very high degree. So the more we reduce that flow through practicing sense restraint, practicing mindfulness, through practicing samatha meditation, we reduce that, reduce that, reduce that, reduce that, reduce that, and we come to get to know things much more intimately. We have this much more personal relationship. Each feeling that's coming up in the body, we can experience that much closely. We have the time to sit down together with that feeling and just gradually get to know it, settle our mind with that, and to get like a quality, deep knowing of things, rather than just a very surface or shallow knowing. So this is one of the very important ways that our practice of samatha will lead to a deepening of our vipassana, of our understanding. So please don't ever think that this teaching of dependent origination is something which is just, you know, too theoretical or too difficult or something. The basis of it is very simple. What you experience in meditation is very simple and direct. Sense experience response, stimulus response. How am I responding? Am I responding with ignorance or with mindfulness? That's what you need to watch. There's a leap which the mind takes from that present moment experience to an overall understanding of the whole of dependent origination. This intuitive leap of wisdom. When you take that leap, the bottom will fall out of your world. When you take that leap, you'll realize that the very foundations of being and consciousness are nothing more than this same round of stimulus and response. This is not something that we can really explain or analyze, nor is there much of a point to doing so? This is like the eureka moment. This is the moment when you suddenly jump out of your bath and run naked down the street, crying, "Eureka, Eureka, I found it." That's that moment. That's that moment of awakening. You can't ever control it. You can't ever predict it. One day it will happen. Maybe like the famous nun who was going to kill herself, threw the rope around the limb of the tree, standing there with the noose, ready to throw herself off, and boom, there she is, she gets enlightened. Or for others, much less dramatic, just throwing away the bowl washing water, and then with mindfulness, contemplating that disappearing into the ground. Is that something that's beyond you? Is that something that's beyond anyone in this room? To watch water disappear into the ground with mindfulness? Now, anyone can hear, can do that. We can all understand it. But what there is that mysterious leap of intuition. We can never make that happen. We can never develop some system, some network that we say we're going to go boom, 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 and then it's going to happen. They can't do it like that. It happens through some mysterious intuition, some ripening of the conditions in our mind. Past life conditions, present life conditions, the way we're using our mind right now, all of those things suddenly go into place, and then that moment one's freed. And in that freeing is a certainty, because that's not a knowledge which is dependent on another person telling you. It's not dependent on faith in another. It's not dependent on some kind of doctrine or anything like that. It's dependent on seeing the truth. When you have that, then that will let go of those doubts. It's what we call stream entry. So that stream enterer is one who sees dependent origination, sees those 12 links and understands them intuitively, and understands that whatever happened in the past, in past lives, whatever happens in the future, in future lives, is just more turnings of this spiral of experience, of stimulus and response that I'm experiencing right here and now. Nothing more and nothing less. So the key element in that insight, in that what they call the breakthrough to the Dhamma, is not that one has accumulated a list of a certain curriculum of knowledge. It's not that one knows a certain amount of things. It can't be defined in terms of any objective criteria of knowledge. It can only be defined in that subjective sense of letting go. When your knowledge is deep enough for you to let go, that is the right kind of knowledge. And that's the only way that we can define it. The knowledge that's good enough to let go. So this is my talk for you this evening on some aspects of dependent origination. So I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite any comments or questions.
It's quite, you talk about the absence of whatever and the positives, or the absence of war and peace, and how, which refers, I think, what you said right at the end, that the essence is the emptiness. But in my tummy, my thirst is not for emptiness. So I don't. Actually, absence of war, I don't find this even too inspiring. I want the real peace, the positive peace, the fulfilling peace. Not just the absence of a disease, but the whole plate of goodies. And still an absence.
So you want to have all the things that you want and none of the things that you don't want?
Well, it's very, very, we're talking about maybe I'm a materialist. Spiritualist, or whatever you call it.
Spiritual materialist.
Yeah. And I'm thirsty. It's physiological. Now, the empty glass is not going to do a trick.
Isn't it?
No, I want.
Has anybody ever been quenched with a full glass? Or is it only when your glass is empty that your thirst is quenched?
Oh, but to start with, glass has to be full.
To start with, it has to be full, but by the end of it, the beginning, the glass is full and you're thirsty. By the end of it, the glass is empty and you're not thirsty.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. So I can have the cake.
That's right.
Buddhist doctrine?
I don't know. I have to ask the expert.